Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. This past Saturday, we had a one-day retreat, a one-day meditation retreat. It went from early morning to early evening. And in the middle of the morning, during one of the meditation periods, the door opened and a man stepped in holding a little girl, his child. She probably three years old, something like that. And he came in, and I could see he was smiling, but then when he saw the people were here and he was sitting in meditation, he was surprised. Big look, big shock, look of shock came on his face. He didn't know anybody was here, and so he looked surprised and he went out. So I followed him outside to see if I could help him. And I asked, I greeted him, welcome. We're having a retreat today. Is there anything I can do for you? How can I help you? And he said, pointing to his daughter, she wants to see Buddha. So I took them to a garden area in the backyard, where we have a very new statue, a Kuan Yin statue, a statue of Kanon. And there was another statue. And so I showed him and her, this is a Buddha. And of course, the statue is very calm and smiling, at peace, with a straight posture. You know, Buddha, sitting Buddha. And the dad was very pleased, and he was talking to her in his language. Not the English language. She's talking to her, explaining to her, it's Buddha. And he was very happy, but she was very shy. She wouldn't look me in the eye. She was shy. She turned away. But she got to see Buddha, the statue of Buddha. And that's what the dad wanted. He wanted her to see Buddha. I don't know why she was interested. Who knows why they came? Maybe it was the father's doing. Come on, let's go see Buddha. Or maybe she heard something. Maybe she saw something. Maybe she was told something. Or maybe something came up in her imagination. She had a vision. Who knows? But they came, and she saw Buddha, and they left. So that was one little girl, but she's not alone. Everybody wants to see Buddha. Not in the same way of that little girl. Not because people have some kind of abstract picture in their mind of Buddha, some image. People want to see Buddha for more concrete reasons relating to their personal life, because they, you know, have been thinking about it. People have a desire or a longing to feel and to know the mind of Buddha. People want to feel the freedom and the enlightenment of Buddha. They want to be Buddha. They want to see Buddha and be Buddha by expressing those qualities of freedom and enlightenment in their own life. They want to feel the calmness, the patience, the wisdom, the kindness, the courtesy, and the confidence of Buddha. And they feel, they want to know how they can live their lives that way. And for the serious person, who's really serious about living their life according to those characteristics, it is a dilemma in today's world. It's a dilemma if you're really serious about seeing Buddha. Because in our in our modern world, it is very difficult to see Buddha. In the world we live in, Buddha qualities seem to be very elusive, very slippery. They feel out of reach. And we constantly feel the pressure to be just the opposite of those qualities. We are pressured to have ambition, to seek for success, to seek for fame, to pursue wealth, and to push progress. This is what we're told. And there's also pressure to compromise our ethics in pursuing these goals. And as we see recent newspaper articles and on the television about people compromising their ethics to achieve success and fame and ambition. So if you want to see Buddha and have the Buddha qualities, you have to work really hard. You have to be very dedicated to not succumb to all those pressures. You know, we cannot stop progress. It seems like we're in such a rush to achieve more and more progress. We are so speedy as a society and as a all over the world. We are in such a rush to have more and more progress day after day. But we can't stop it. We can't stop it. We cannot tell people, stop making progress. Can't do it. It's in our DNA. Human beings have always felt and recognized the need to be creative, to create something in order to improve their lives and to constantly build new worlds. This is what we do, human beings. But the problem has become that all advances in progress and in technology and in things that make our lives better or easier, more convenient, all of these things have downsides. Every advance has a downside. For some, it may not look like it. But if you look carefully at every new thing that's considered to be an advance or a progress, there's a downside there. There's a potential problem there. And it is inevitable. You can't invent anything that doesn't have a downside. It's not possible. Because when we bring something new into the world because of our creativity and our ingenuity and our imagination and our energy, when we bring something new into the world, the new thing needs its own space. And so the things that are already in our world need to adjust to make some room for the change. And sometimes the adjustment is not difficult. But sometimes the progress can create conflict in the world we live in and can even create harm. One example, of downside, of a major downside, and the difficulty of handling it, was the smog that existed in Los Angeles back in the 1940s, way back. My wife worked in Los Angeles for 1 year at a time. She says it was terrible. You know, you could never see the mountains and the air was always bad. There were great smog problems in the 1940s. People had trouble breathing. And in 1952, a scientist at Caltech identified the source of the smog problem. He said, it's the oil industry and automobiles. But the executives from the auto company said, no way. No, it's not. It's not our fault. In 1953, the engineers from Ford said, smog will dissipate in the atmosphere. No problem. Smog does not present an air pollution problem. These were the engineers for an automotive company. So there was very fierce denial. And in the 1950s, the state of California, the legislature of the state of California, required all automobiles coming out of Detroit to have anti-smog devices. You know, catalytic converter cost about $200. And the executive said, oh, well, that will increase the cost of the cars, and people can't afford them, and they won't buy them, and we'll all be out of business. Well, as we know, the catalytic converter did not harm the auto industry. And the auto industry is doing better than ever. And by the way, Los Angeles is mostly smog-free. So not admitting to the downside of this great invention, the automobile, really improved lives a lot. Without admitting to it and taking responsibility for it, it became a major problem, and the inventors and the managers went into denial. There are other industries with similar stories, with resistance and denial. Pesticides was one. Pesticides company said, it's not our chemical that's hurting. And of course, the tobacco industry was into great denial. It was in 1993. The state of Florida held a hearing and brought in 7 executives from the major tobacco companies, and they all denied that smoking is addictive. They were asked directly, each one. They all denied that smoking is addictive. Downside. a lot of people like smoking. But the executives were afraid to admit that there's a downside because, you know, sales would go down. And today in our high-tech industries, people are beginning to recognize that there are downsides that are not so obvious, like smoke in the air, you know, or pollution in the rivers from pesticides. Cell phones and social media, along with automobiles and other technologies, have been a great benefit to the mobile world. With people moving around and being separated from families and friends, and it's hard to stay in touch. And the phones, and the social media has really helped with that. It's been a great benefit to people to stay in touch. And those devices are now embedded in our culture. But we, in recent years, have become aware of the unintended consequences of such devices. One example is, despite the benefit of social media, studies have shown that it is greatly responsible for the rise in teenage loneliness and suicide. Who knew? Who could predict such a thing? And also, cell phones and social media, we now know, very useful if you want to spy on somebody, or if you want to hack somebody, if you want to steal from them. That technology can help with that. That's a big downside. Nobody anticipated it would be used for that. And these downsides were not anticipated by the entrepreneurs and the creators of the technology. Just not anticipated. So the question today is, what is the responsibility of the developer of a new product or a new technology? What is the responsible? What is the responsibility of the entrepreneurs to address these downsides? Should they not care? Should they not say, what we're giving you is a great benefit? If something develops that you don't like, you'll have to fix it. It's not our responsibility. What should their responsibility be? This is a question that's now being asked. And in the past several months especially. But our dilemma today is that technology companies are not interested in managing the responsibility. They don't care about that. They don't want to manage the potential downsides of their new product or of their new service or their new technology. Generally, it's dismissed as the cost of doing business. You ever hear of that expression? The cost of doing business. So it's dismissed. Because these creative people and these entrepreneurs and these managers, their goal is profits. Their goal is increasing their own wealth by providing a service that people will pay money for. So if you tell them, you know, you really have to manage the responsibility of the downsides, they'll say, well, there's a cost to doing that. And that cost will impact our profit. And that cost will impact our stock price. And we will lose customers. This is the argument. It's the same argument as the automobile executives used. But the nature of the world has changed. New products and new technologies and new services can be put within reach of millions of people all over the world almost instantly these days. You know, can go viral very fast. Instead, in the old way, the advances in progress, the advances in products and in services was, you know, incrementally, one at a time, because you couldn't reach all these, so many people all at once. I was trying to think of an example of that, and the first thing that came to mind was a mattress. Now, maybe this isn't the best example, but I'll use it. So let's say you're looking at television and there's an ad for a mattress, a new technology mattress. And you look at it, yeah, I think I could use a new mattress. I haven't been sleeping well. So there's a very, very appealing promotion, television and in the paper. And it says, this new technology mattress is very firm, supports you well. It's flexible, you can move around. And it has automatic temperature control. The mattress knows your temperature. And it will adjust itself to be perfectly comfortable. And you say, my gosh, I need that. But maybe a few years later, it was discovered that the material to make up the mattress is toxic. Who knew? And people get sick. But that happens for one family at a time, you know. The mattress company doesn't sell millions of mattresses overnight. One at a time, people discover the mattress and they buy it. So families buy mattresses, and after a year, maybe there's a few thousand mattresses that have to be recalled. That's a nuisance. It's a downside that is inconvenient, but it's not a global disaster. However, with technology products, the potential downsides are scaled up because they reach people so quickly. And if there is a downside in the product, the resulting problems are worldwide, and there's no easy way to recall the product. So the problem is not just local, it's worldwide. So today, as you all know, biotechnology and artificial intelligence are seeking to change the meaning of humanity. If you look at what serious thinkers are saying, AI can change the whole meaning of humanity. For example, should we be encouraging algorithms that will tease out to determine and fulfill all human desires? If AI promises that, people may say that's exactly what I want. But is that really good for us? Is there not a downside in doing that? So, because there are potential serious impacts to users worldwide, the investors and the owners and all of society need to take responsibility for exploring potential negative effects of new services, of new products, of new techniques. So the world has changed, and the unintended consequences of progress can be extremely harmful. But if we, in order to take care, in order to take responsibility, to make sure we don't introduce serious downsides into our world, we first have to care. We have to say, despite all these wonderful advantages that this new thing may give me, I have to care that it may possibly cause me harm. So one approach, one theoretical approach might be that the owners and leaders of companies and enterprises, they appoint somebody I will call a downside czar. Downsides are somebody who has the responsibility for looking for downsides, so it doesn't get ignored. Czar, committee, whatever you want to call it, somebody, some people are dedicated to trying to find out if there's a problem here. So they investigate possible downsides during the early development of a product or technology. So they would, I can imagine they would work with the coders and the developers. They would know the product and the, or the service. They would know what it is intended to do and how it does it. And by being engaged in the process early, they would know the minds of the developers. So they might be able to identify bias or something like that. Anyway, it's a, it could be a complicated process. But downsides are like a policeman. When concern for a downside, for concern that a downside might creep in or be invented into a new product or service, when that becomes a concern for the investors and for the owners, then the creativity of the developers will expand, because they will be have a wider view of what they're doing. The developers will not be concerned just with the function of creating ways for this new product to do something well. They will be concerned with more than that. And if an enterprise concerns itself, takes the responsibility for trying, at least trying to find downsides and prevent them from becoming harmful, this company, this enterprise will be developing a conscience. Today, we're not sure that the companies that provide us these products that we like or these services or these technologies, we're not sure they have a conscience. We say, thank you. Here's my credit card number. I got it. We don't care if they have a conscience, as long as we get the product. But wouldn't it be nice if, and I won't name any names, you probably can guess, wouldn't it be nice if these enterprises had a conscience and they provided their services or their product with the well-being of the user in mind and not just how much money they can get or how much of their personal data they can get. If they had the well-being of the consumer in mind. Conscience means they would be concerned for people's well-being and not just the money. But such an idea as that is not likely to happen soon. Because you can imagine some executive saying, you know, if somebody discovers a possible downside in this new thing I'm building, it might hurt the projected sales. It might even kill the project. So I don't want to look at it. I don't want to know about it. So the focus will be limited to the tangible return on investment and not what harm might be created. So I think the owners, where we are today, the owners are not interested in exploring. And that kind of orientation will not change for a long, long time. So let me return to the little girl who came on Saturday to see Buddha. Individuals who are concerned, those of us, those of you, anybody who is concerned that the introduction of a new technology could carry, you know, like a virus, could have a downside, could cause harm. If we're concerned about such things, we don't need to wait for management to have a reorientation. We don't need to wait to do something. So if you've ever asked, if you have ever heard anybody ask the question, how do I take this Zen practice into my daily life? Or how do I see Buddha? The answer is, you have to have the attitude of a downside czar. Maintain your downside czar attitude in everything we do, not just in the product we're developing, in everything we do, be a downside czar through the use of your imagination and especially your awareness. Everything you do. In other words, this practice asks us to make our best effort to identify what might be harmful in our relationships and in the things we do. And in Buddhism, this is known as skillful means. And as you practice and as you read some more, you'll understand what that means and how to go about it. When we have this attitude, when we instinctively try to apply skillful means to areas that could be troublesome, we find great satisfaction. Because we all want to take responsibility. We all want to take responsibility. So our practice is asking us to fulfill that responsibility and not be distracted by the energies of society that pull us away. This is our practice, and each one of us has to figure out for themselves how they can take on this responsibility of being a downside czar. If you do it, you'll find great satisfaction. You will know that you have been vigilant, that you're watching out for everybody else. You've been vigilant, you have been vigilant on behalf of others, not just yourself. You'll find satisfaction in that. And this attitude is how we take our practice into our work and into our life. So Saturday was a great day when that little girl showed up with her father, wanting to see Buddha. I wanted to say to her, everybody wants to see Buddha. But we let it go. But it's true, she's not alone. So I'll leave you with that story. Does anybody have a question tonight? Yes, please.
The downside czar you mentioned in certain organizations, I think it's referred to as the inspector general.
The inspector general.
Yes. And as you pointed out, that there are certain issues with that. And I think the term people use is this regulatory capture. regulatory capture. They capture the person who's making the regulations. Oh. Yes. I was wondering if also diversity in the workforce of these organizations you mentioned could potentially answer the question. Because as you pointed out, everyone, there is a bit of homogeneity in thinking for the quest for progress. And I was wondering if the diversity in the workforce would possibly help with that.
Well, that's a good question. And I believe so. I believe a diverse workforce brings together different points of view, different backgrounds, different ways of thinking, different ways of seeing the world. And I think when they come together, they can create something that has a bigger view than if it's a homogeneous workforce. I think it can expand the viewpoint of the workforce. I believe that's right. I'm confident that that's what will happen. Thank you. Umar.
So that's one of my friends went to Spain around 10 years ago. And this came back to me. And he said, he went to a coffee shop and said, "Can I get it to go?" And they looked at him and said, "You want to sit down and drink coffee? Drink coffee. You must be American. You want it to go. We don't do to go. You sit down, you drink, and you leave. We don't do this to go business at all." And recently I was watching the news, I think it was yesterday or day before yesterday, where Canada is banning all single-use containers because they want to control plastic around the coast that's coming in, that's being dumped into the ocean. And I was thinking that this is what you're talking about, that change is coming now. That the government in Canada has stood up and said, we don't want this anymore. We need to clean up they're saying there's too much plastic in the natural forests now. People are going and dumping stuff over there, too much in the oceans. They've started a process of cleaning the oceans and the forests and everything, and they're banning all kinds of single-use items, products. Mm-hmm. It's really so there is some progress being made in that direction.
Yes. When were paper cups invented? 20 years ago, 50 years ago? Mm-hmm. And when they came out, plastic cups, paper cups, people, oh, isn't that wonderful? Now we can leave the coffee shop and walk around. Isn't that wonderful? And everybody celebrated it. And it took 50 years to recognize the problem. And now the cleanup will be very expensive. What if we could use our imagination and foretell the potential downsides of those kinds of advances? So good for Canada. I wonder if our friends at Starbucks know about that. Thank you. Yes.
Thanks for your talk. So I don't think I have laid out my question really well in my mind. I just probably go through it. So what is your advice for us if we want to be our own self-regulators in terms of our own digital well-being? What's your advice for us as practitioners? What are the values that we should watch for? What should we be practicing, basically, when we are using technology?
I think the main thing, or maybe the first thing, is when we become aware of something or a potential something, that we don't ignore it and say, "Oh, that's somebody else's responsibility, it's not mine," or "I don't have time," or something like that. If we see something that might be harmful, We have to do something. We can't just turn our back on it and get on with what we think is more productive. We have to do something, make other people aware, or some, I don't know what it is, but first thing is to not turn away from it, to accept it and take responsibility for trying to initiate some action. I think that's the main thing. It's, you know, it all starts with caring. We have to care. If we don't care, then we'll dismiss it. I noticed this morning, maybe it was yesterday, after morning meditation here, those of us that are here go over to the local Starbucks for coffee, a little bit of community. Small group, 6, 8, sometimes 10 people, we go there. And I noticed yesterday when I pulled into a parking place, you'd gone back out and you picked up 2 empty soda cans. You picked up 3 cans from people that throw them in the parking lot. And you picked them up and you... That's a little thing like that. Take care of the small thing when you see it's a problem. It starts there. It's when we have the big thing that... then we have to become a whistleblower, I guess.
Yeah. So, thank you. I have one follow-up, if you don't mind. So now that technology knows us really well and can manipulate us in some ways with its own algorithms, how should we be aware of ourselves better, to know ourselves better, so that we are not being manipulated by these technologies and be alienated from ourselves?
Well, that's where this practice comes in. Through this practice, we develop our capacity to be aware, awareness of ourselves, awareness of the things going on around us. We don't get distracted as easily the more we practice. And that's the basis of what we do, to be aware of ourselves so that we can be in this world honestly without being fooled. Because what you talk about is a big problem. There's a lot of technologies out there trying to manipulate us all the time. So it's our own awareness of ourselves, and if we're being pulled in a way that doesn't feel right, to come back. So this practice has arrived in this country just at the right time. Thank you.
So my question is, how should we view, I guess, change and how to tackle how we handle the downsides of certain things that are inevitable, or in order to counter them, we need to make decisions that are very hard to make in our lives. For example, I'm sure a lot of people maybe here or friends and family here work in the tech industry.
Yeah.
I think housing prices here are not really a surprise to anyone. And a side effect of that has been a lot of displacement of people, gentrification, which has its own issues. But at the same time, it would be very hard for honest people here to give up what they view that they work very hard for the sake of the people who are being displaced. So in terms of downsides like these, where it's very hard to make a decision that would change the impact of the downside, and awareness is oftentimes not enough, how would you say we handle these types of things?
So when we have been fortunate enough to have a lifestyle that's comfortable, safe, and provides us what we want, and some change comes, like homelessness, and we feel, uh-oh, that's a threat. I think we have to be ready to provide some space. How much or how little, I don't know. We have to be ready to accommodate some change that needs accommodation. You know, if we say, take that problem to some other neighborhood, and that neighborhood says, I'm throwing it back to you, then we don't get anywhere. So if we can all be willing to make some small accommodation to these disruptions, I think collectively we can make it happen. That's why, you know, people in government who try to get neighborhoods to accept change, they try to find a way where it's not, it doesn't have too much of an impact. So changes can be accommodated relatively comfortably. And to find out what that, the level of comfort, and where people would be willing to say, okay, I will accommodate. You need to have a lot of discussion and a lot of group, a lot of people coming together. And those, sometimes those coming together are themselves disruptive. So it is a big challenge when changes come and try to take the place of something already there that people want to hold on to. Really a problem. It's happening all over the globe. But if each of us is willing to make a little bit of accommodation, maybe that little bit multiplied many times can help things happen. But like you say, it's not easy. Thank you.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if, as you were talking about that and speaking about diversity and these various concerns in technology and AI, if there have been any interfaith meetings or perhaps gathering and then organized presence at talks and discussions to give feedback around those things. For example, there's, say, Leela, there's a talk at PARC tomorrow about Leela, which is an AI, constructivist-based AI program that is coming out. And so there's a, you know, they're going to do a program about the project, and there'll be an audience and probably some discussion afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if there has been, in the context of this entire discussion, any gathering of various leaders of the community of faith, various faiths, because I think you were talking about those particular places that people are most willing within the community to, or have comfort level in providing support. So a lot of that often comes up around spirituality. Mm. So I was wondering if there's been...
I'm not aware of any interfaith activity around this subject. I'm not seeing any newsletters or emails or anything. It doesn't mean it's not happening, I just haven't seen anything. Could be useful. Could be useful, depending upon how it's organized and who the leaders are. But I'm not aware of anything. Maybe soon. Maybe soon. Something to think about. Thank you for your question. Okay. Do we have any announcements tonight?
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.